The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th Century. The 8th Century. The 4th Century. The best of the Church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Well, here on Issues, Etc., we often use terms our listeners, our regular listeners, might be familiar with. We talk about Pop American Christianity or Pop American Protestantism. What do those terms mean? When we take it apart here, we usually talk about churches that are ahistorical, that is, they have very little regard for Christian history, that they're asacramental, that they don't have any emphasis, if any at all, on the sacraments as presented in Holy Scripture. They're aliturgical. They tend to be reinventing the wheel as often as they can in Christian worship. And they're achristological. They focus more on the Christian rather than the Christ. That's what we mean by the terms like Pop American Christianity. But you know what? Another term for that could just be Protestant. What is Protestantism? What was it and what has it become, especially in the American religious landscape? Joining us to talk about Reformational Catholicism on this Tuesday afternoon, November the 26th, Peter Lighthart. He's president of Trinity House. He's author of the forthcoming book, Gratitude and Intellectual History. And he's written a recent column for First Things titled The End of Protestantism. Peter, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thanks very much, Todd.
You say that Protestantism isn't what the church, including Protestants themselves, needs today. What do you mean by that?
In the article, I was playing around with the term Protestant. As you know, it has the term protest in it, and it's frequently been understood to be primarily a movement of protest against Roman Catholic abuses. In my tradition, particularly in the Reformed tradition, and I think in a lot of low church traditions in Baptist and free church traditions, there's a fair amount of knee-jerk reaction to Catholicism and a fair amount of defining Protestantism over against Catholicism. And what I was targeting in the article was that particular knee-jerk reaction to Catholicism. I think the Catholic Church has moved on. Protestantism is not what it was in the 16th or 17th century. And I think we also face different sorts of challenges. So I want Protestants to get over the kind of knee-jerk anti-Catholicism that's characterized much of our tradition.
So this is probably why, from the Lutheran perspective, that's my perspective, confessional Lutherans tend to bristle at the notion of being called Protestants because of everything it connotes, especially in the American and the Western religious landscape. It's just another name for kind of soft anti-Catholicism. Is that what you're talking about?
That's what I'm talking about. And yeah, I think you certainly have traditions that are coming out of the Reformation that aren't Protestant in the sense I was using the term in that article. The Lutheran tradition is one, Anglican tradition, and some sectors of the Reformed tradition, for example, in liturgical life, Lutherans and Anglicans place a lot of emphasis on formal set liturgies. The liturgy is the high point of the piety and the life of the church. In lower church, free church traditions, that's not the case. And sometimes it's just, again, a reaction to Catholicism and for a lot of low church Protestants, a Lutheran liturgy looks like it looks just like a Catholic liturgy, which obviously it's not.
What is Reformational Catholicism? Is that term original with you, or how would you explain it?
Yeah, it's the kind of terminology that I've been using for a number of years with a group of Reformed theologians, and what we're getting at is a couple of things. One is trying to get at the commitment to reformational distinctives and the recovery of the gospel of pure grace, all of the liturgical reforms that took place during the course of the Reformation, and we want to affirm our commitment to those distinctive beliefs that came out of the Reformation, those Protestant beliefs. At the same time, we want to function as Christians who recognize our brotherhood with believers in other traditions. And that really does, in the first instance, that's probably is a brotherhood that we need to work at with other Protestants. The focus of the article that I wrote had to do with Protestant-Catholic relations, but there are plenty of internal divisions within the Reformational churches that I think have been exaggerated in various ways more than they need to be, and I think also have created in some ways a travesty and a tragedy in the modern world. The splintering of Protestantism in my Presbyterian tradition, churches spring up pretty regularly. There are new churches all the time. Churches split and new denominations show up, and any sense of unity as a single body in Christ is very much lost in that setting.
So where do you think the home of Protestantism, as you describe it in your article, where does it find its home today? Where would you locate it?
Yeah, I think it's, in my mind, it's in various places. I think you have it in my immediate tradition, again, is Reformed and Presbyterian. You have it in some parts of the Reformed churches, a sense of commitment to the Reformation, at the same time a spirit of brotherhood with other denominations. I think you find it in certain respects in Lutheran churches and in Anglican churches, though I think particularly in the Lutheran church, there's, for various reasons, there's a tendency, I would call it a tendency towards sectarianism that divides Lutherans off from other Protestants. And that's part of the target of the term, is to try to overcome those divisions and try to at least function, even if we're not denominationally united, at least function as brothers in Christ and function as a united church.
What's the role of the so-called church growth movement, or kind of the seeker-driven impulse in American Protestantism? I usually call it pop American Protestantism or something like that. Where do you see that role?
Well, I think that's it's hard for me to judge in general. From the things that I would be most attentive to in that movement have to do with what I think are some fairly significant liturgical failures. The liturgy is not a matter of evangelism, even. It's not a matter of entertainment, certainly. The liturgy is God's service to us and our receptive thanksgiving to God for the gifts that he gives us. And when then that was really at the heart of the Reformation, liturgical reforms, was an effort to put the means of grace back into the hands of the people. Instead of a closed Bible, the Bible was read and proclaimed to the people. Instead of a table that was fenced off and not available to people, the table was opened up and lay people could come and participate in communion. That was at the heart of the Reformation liturgical reform. And I think in a lot of church growth and other sectors, the accent is not on God's gifts to us in the liturgy, but rather on how we can redesign the liturgy in order to appeal to outsiders, in order to attract a crowd. And I think that's really missing the heart of both the heart of the Reformation, also the heart of what I think is the purpose of worship, which is, again, to receive God's gifts through Christ and the Spirit, and then by the Spirit to offer our thanks and praise to him for those gifts.
How would you respond to someone who says, well, you know, but a lot of those big box churches, especially in America, are populated by expatriated Roman Catholics, former Roman Catholics, who say, well, I never got this or that in my church. And you can walk in there and ask for a show of hands, how many were you raised Catholic? Sometimes it's more than a majority in those big box evangelical churches.
Right. Well, that's certainly the case. They're appealing to people that, in some cases, and obviously not universally the case, but they're appealing to people who have had certain kinds of experience in church and have become disenchanted with that. I think you'd probably find a lot of people in those churches that have come out of Lutheran or Presbyterian or Anglican churches as well. And I think that I would have a couple of responses to that. One is I don't despise the work that the Lord is doing in those churches. That's again part of the aim of a reformational Catholicism is to acknowledge our Christian brothers in whatever sector of the church that they're in, and that includes free church, pop evangelical churches, as you call them. Those are our brothers too. So, and I don't want to despise at all the work that the Lord is doing in those churches. I know many people are coming to know Jesus through their ministry, so I'm grateful for that. But I think that the couple things I would say in response to the question, one would be, I think that does signal a failure of churches that put more of an accent on formal liturgy. I think it signals a failure when people don't realize what that liturgy is for and also don't have the experience of actually receiving those gifts that the liturgy is designed to deliver to them. You know, people go through a liturgy for the first 20 years of their life and say that they never really encountered Christ. That may be their problem, but it may also be, I think it's a wake-up call for churches to think, churches that have a liturgical tradition, to think more seriously about how that liturgical tradition should work. So I think there's that's on the one hand, that I think that the fact that people are drifting into these low church settings is a moment for self-examination for our churches. I think it's also obviously these pop evangelical churches appeal to a kind of American tenor. They have a very American flavor, very contemporary flavor. They're easy to fit into and easy to blend into, I think that's something of the explanation for their growth and power. But I think it's also in some ways it's a signal of a failure in my mind, because the church should not be just blending in with the surrounding culture so that you can't really tell when you're out. You know, as you step into church, you should be stepping into a place with a different atmosphere and a different set of priorities and a different pattern of life than you have out in the world. And insofar as these churches are conforming themselves to the world in order to appeal to people, then I think that's a failure, that's a pastoral and mission failure.
Peter Lighthart is our guest, president of Trinity House, author of the forthcoming book, Gratitude and Intellectual History. He's also written a recent column for First Things titled The End of Protestantism. 10 more minutes with him on the other side of the break. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. Would you like to learn about the Reformation theology you hear on Issues, Etc.? We'll send you a pamphlet of Luther's Small Catechism for free. It contains the biblical teachings on the Ten Commandments, the Apostles' Creed, the Lord's Prayer, Baptism, the Lord's Supper, and Confession and Absolution. Order your free copy of Luther's Small Catechism today. Just send your name and mailing address to talkback@issuesetc.org.
What happens when you take solid doctrine and solid curriculum and combine them with ancient scholars and modern technology? You get Wittenberg Academy, the very first completely online classical Lutheran high school. We are unabashedly Lutheran and offer families a rigorous standard of academic excellence. Students can pick and choose classes, or they can utilize our entire curriculum for their high school education. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.
Evangelical and Catholic. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Does your church need a full-time or backup organist? The virtual organist service from Church Music Solutions is genuine organ leadership using your instrument with your specific selections when you need it. You can try it out for free with our demo unit, which allows you and your members to hear and see the virtual organist without obligation and without a sales pitch. For more details, go to churchmusicsolutions.com.
Martin Luther taught that the chief function of music and worship was the proclamation of the Word of God. With Heirs of the Reformation, Treasures of the Singing Church, you will hear over two centuries of Lutheran musical theology, beautifully performed and faithfully sung. For a limited time, save 10% on this 4-CD set when you use promotional code URA. Simply visit cph.org today. Lutheran Thought, Lutheran Substance, Lutheran Music. Brought to you by Concordia Publishing House.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. on this Tuesday afternoon, November the 26th. We're talking about Reformational Catholicism with Peter Lightheart. He has written a recent column for First Things titled The End of Protestantism. Picking up on something you said before the break, it sounds like what you're saying is, with regard to those churches that have abandoned the historic liturgy, we need to acknowledge that perhaps we have failed to catechize Sunday by Sunday, teaching people basically, look, this isn't just rote formalism. This is, in fact, as we'd say in the Lutheran tradition, the framework for the means of grace.
Right. Yes, exactly. You know, I know that it's something of a hard sell, but I know from my own experience, I've pastored two churches where we moved from having a fairly infrequent celebration of the Eucharist to having a weekly celebration of the Eucharist. And after the you go through that transition, and there's some opposition, and there's some you have to work through some objections to that. But once the move is made and people the Eucharist becomes just a part of the rhythm of people's lives, it becomes something that they can hardly imagine being without. It's just part of what you do when you go to church. You go to church, and the Lord's there to speak to you in His Word, and He's there to feed you at His table, and that's what it means to be invited into God's house and worship. So I think that, it does take a lot of teaching, and it does take particularly in the church's settings that I'm coming from, where you don't have a set tradition of liturgy, and there's people who want to move in that direction have to do a lot of building of liturgical sensibilities among people who don't naturally have them. But I think that's the payoff, I think, is tremendous, and I think that it's definitely worth the effort to, as you say, to catechize and to teach people what the liturgy is about.
For me, the touchstone is, coming from the Lutheran perspective, the Lutheran confessions, which present themselves, if they're read honestly, they present themselves as thoroughly Catholic. It might have been naivete on the part of the Lutheran confessors in the 16th century, but they actually believed that if given a chance, if given the counsel they were calling for from the papacy, that everyone would acknowledge that what they were confessing there in the Lutheran confessions was thoroughly and completely Catholic in the best sense of the term. So what role in your mind do a reappropriation of the historic creeds and confessions of the church play in all of this?
Yeah, well, I think that's I do think that's a good point. Years ago, I read an article by the Lutheran theologian David Diego, where he argued for the Catholicity of the Reformation. And he said, particularly with Luther, that Luther's Reformation turn comes by his deeper insight into the tradition of the church. It's not by abandoning the tradition, but it's by a deeper reappropriation of that tradition that he comes to his Reformation insights. So I think that's again the term that I've been using, Reformational Catholicism. That's part of what that implies. It means an embrace of our brothers in other church traditions in the present, but it also means recognizing the whole church's history as our heritage. And that doesn't mean we're uncritical of things that went on in the past. Everyone has family members who are kind of an embarrassment to have in your family tree. And the Bible has genealogies, and you have embarrassments in the genealogies in the Bible. So acknowledging the whole history and the whole church as our heritage is doesn't mean we're uncritical of it, but it does mean that this is our heritage, and any effort at furthering and deepening the Reformation has to be in touch with that heritage and has to be, in part at least, a recovery of the insights of that. At the same time, I also think that there's just trying to repristinate the Reformation is not the way to go. It's not what the future, what the church of the future should be doing. We face different sorts of challenges. We face different sort of cultural challenges in our day. We face a very different kind of church situation with a Catholic church that's quite different from what it was in the late Middle Ages. We face a Protestantism that's been fractured. So I think just trying to repeat the slogans of the Reformation is not adequate. But anything we do beyond that, I think, has to be growing out of a deep understanding of what the Reformation was aiming for.
And it sounds like you're saying that this is not simply, the goal here is not simply to reappropriate the term Catholic.
Right. Not just not the term. Is that what you're saying? It's not about the term. It's about a certain spirit in Protestant churches. Yes.
Should we try and dispense with the term Protestant? Has it worn out its welcome? Is it outlived its usefulness?
The article suggested that, but again, I was using the word in a specific way for rhetorical value. And I think it still has its value in maybe reformational is preferable. Part of the reason for using reformational too, Protestant can't have this connotation, but using reformational is a way of talking about the common heritage that we have with other churches that come out of the Reformation. Through the centuries, Reformed and Lutheran churches have been at odds on any number of points. And again, part of what I think the church needs to be working at in the present is to see what we can do to heal those breaches, and again, to at least work in as co-belligerents, even if we're not working in the same denominational structure. So I use the article use the terms in the article for rhetorical reasons. I'm not quibbling over term zone if Protestant is still descriptive, and I do think it is. I think it's worth retaining. But it's again the knee-jerk reaction against everything Catholic that I want to expel from Protestantism.
You mentioned earlier our history, that is kind of relearning the history of the church itself.
Right.
My characterization often of generic Protestantism is that it is profoundly ahistorical, almost to the degree of kind of Mormonesque, where you had the Age of the Apostles, then a great period of darkness, and then maybe the 16th century Reformation. Maybe they would even include that in the period of darkness. Maybe, who knows, the awakenings of American revivalism, this kind of dismissive nature of
right.
the church's history. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, I do think that's a peculiar, maybe a specifically American kind of phenomenon. And I mean, it's a kind of Anabaptist narrative of church history, that you have a fall of the church early on when perhaps you dated at the time of Constantine's conversion, or at some point when the church took a more Catholic form, and then you have this big parenthesis for a millennium until the Reformation. Even the Reformation is still kind of halfway Catholic, according to this Anabaptist narrative. And the only true church that existed throughout the Middle Ages are these little pockets of resistance to the main church. I think that's a bad misreading of, in a lot of particulars, I think it's a bad misreading of the history of the church. And I also just think it's in some ways a really safe reading, because if the church basically didn't exist for a millennium, then all the failures of the church are not our problem. that's somebody else's problem to have to deal with. Well, I mean, when you look at the history of Israel, it's narrated in various places in the Bible. You look at Psalm 78 and the narration of the dark saying and the parable about Israel's history that's given in that psalm. It's certainly not ignoring the periods of apostasy and evil and idolatry. That's part of the history of Israel. So for Christians to kind of delete those memories from our past, I think is a really it's a dangerous thing to do. It's not the way the Bible deals with the history of the people of God. And again, it seems to me far too safe. We have to grapple with the evils of our forefathers. We have to grapple with the failures of judgment that our Christian predecessors had. That's part of our history, and we need to reckon with that and seek to be faithful in the light of the history that we've received.
Finally, with only about 30 seconds here, you use the phrase, the original Catholic vision of the Reformers. In about 30 seconds, how would you describe that?
Well, part of it is what you've already said, and I've already said, is that Luther has this deeper insight into Christology, into the nature of the Eucharist, into God's gift for his people. And Calvin, too, sometimes is seen as a more radical kind of reformer, but he was very much in tune with the early church. He was a great reader of Augustine, knew John Chrysostom and quoted John Chrysostom fairly frequently. Also, was not he was willing to quote the better scholastics. He didn't reject medieval theology in toto. So there's a sense of a grasp of the tradition, and an effort to reform that tradition. That's but it's an effort to be reforming within the Universal Catholic Church. That was the original vision.
Dr. Peter Lighthart is president of Trinity House. He's author of the forthcoming book, Gratitude and Intellectual History, and he's written a column recently for First Things titled The End of Protestantism. You can read this column at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Lighthart, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you very much.
You know, that perspective that we talk about so much here on Issues, Etc., that ahistorical, asacramental, aliturgical, achristological perspective that typifies American Protestantism, you won't find it in the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for November, Five Things You Can Do to Live a Jesus-Centered Life. The author, Pastor Heath Curtis, is a regular guest here on the program, and it centers squarely upon the history, the sacramental nature of the church, the liturgical nature of the church, and the Christological nature of the church. That's what you'll find in the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for November. Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House and order the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for November, Five Things You Can Do to Live a Jesus-Centered Life by Pastor Heath Curtis, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. In hour two of Issues, Etc., we're going to spend some time with Pastor Ted Giese reviewing the movie Hunger Games: Catching Fire, and then we'll be in the Old Testament, finding Christ there in Isaiah chapter 2, the mountain of the Lord. Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer will be our guest.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
The grace of God, the church's music, the Lord's Supper, every service, every Sunday, and Wednesdays too, preaching Christ crucified and risen. There is hope in St. Louis, Hope Lutheran Church, that is, 5218 Neosho Street, St. Louis, Missouri, or find us on the web at hopelutheranstl.org.
Are you thankful for the worldwide outreach of Issues, Etc.? Please consider making a special Thanksgiving gift. You can donate online at issuesetc.org. You can also make a special Thanksgiving contribution by check. Make your check payable to Issues, Etc. and send it to Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. With 5 weeks left in 2013, we're $73,000 short of making budget. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.